Welcome to another edition of Geopolitics and Empire. A quick reminder to support the broadcast, $5 a month on Substack, become a paid subscriber, or $50 a year. You could also buy me coffee and send reinforcement through DonorBox. We're joined today by writer, civil nuclear engineer, podcast host, and energy analyst, Hugo Brugger. Welcome back to the podcast, Hugo.
Thanks, Jorge. Thanks for having me.
I think this is your third appearance, possibly, and you do a lot of great work, and you know you're originally from South Africa, and so we're going to be focusing on that today. And you've been writing a few pieces, you know, South Africa's involvement with the Israel-Gaza affair and the ICJ, and then you wrote a fantastic piece for Piers Robinson's Propaganda in Focus on, as a result of that, the Western Empire. You say that it's your suspicion that Washington, local actors, or the Israeli lobby will most likely try and use propaganda to intervene in the next election in South Africa with the purpose of punishing the ANC for, quote, bad behavior. So what's going on here?
Yeah, so I mean, this isn't shocking to anyone in your audience, but if you go against the Washington mafia, they try and intervene. They try and instigate coup d'etats, use propaganda, use media attacks against the president, Ramaphosa, at the moment. Now, I myself am not a big fan of the ANC government. I think they got far too much good press outside of South Africa. So in a way, you know, I should actually be welcoming it, but I know what's going to happen, which is why I don't welcome it. So to give people a little bit of a summary about South African politics, South Africa has got 11 languages. We've got a variety of tribes and peoples. And it's a complicated sort of multicultural society. So it's always easy to play one group off over the other. Even though the ANC government, since Nelson Mandela, has won 2/3 of the vote, there's big internal factions within the ANC. And Ramaphosa, who's the president at the moment, came to power, ironically, on the back of the South African-Israeli lobby. Okay, his brother-in-law is a man by the name of Patrice Motsepe, who sits on the World Economic Forum. Ramaphosa is like one of the top 5 to 10 richest guys in the country, and his brother-in-law is number 3. So he's an oligarch, basically. And he came to power through the business community. Now, I don't know if Ramaphosa's always been a difficult guy to read. So I don't know what his intention was of Israel, but I got the impression that he was a little bit hesitant of going to the ICJ. However, people within the ANC and throughout the larger society was like overwhelmingly in support of the Palestinians. And there's a long history as to why, especially the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, had a lot of sympathy with the Palestinians. And anyways, the unions in South Africa, various factions within the ANC put a lot of pressure on the government to do something. And then they got a hold of the ICJ idea, taking Israel to the International Criminal Court of Justice. Not exactly sure how that happened, but I suspect they read Francis Boyle's work, who proposed it initially. And then, yeah, they took them there for genocide in Gaza. They claimed there's genocide. Okay. Now, what I'm seeing in the build-up to our next election, which is in March, is that certain elements within the local press are spreading false narratives about the government. So there's allegations that they are funded by Russia. There's allegations that they got money from Iran, which is what my piece covered. And it happens to be my wife's Iranian, so I know I can sort of fact check that as well, if you will. That they got money from. Now, the story that goes is that the South African government got money from Iran. And this is why they took Israel to the International Court of Justice, because they needed money for the election campaign. Now, that just sounds absurd on the face of it. And if you know anything about the conflict, you'd know that Hamas and Iran are not always aligned. I mean, Hamas is not Iran's proxy. One is Shiite, one is Sunni, for example. Hamas came out of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it happens to be that Qatar and even Mossad at one stage funded Hamas, right? Iran, as far as we know, did give training and stuff. But the idea that the South African government would be acting on behalf of Iran is absolutely absurd if you know anything about South African politics, because in every election in South Africa, the Palestinian issue comes up. It's a very sensitive issue in South Africa. So even if Iran presumably gave money, of which there is still no evidence, this is not why the government acted. And so, yeah, so the story is basically that the foreign press and the local press, certain elements, are spreading the story that the South African government is the diplomatic proxy of Iran. The chief rabbi in South Africa, a man by the name of Warren Goldstein, went to APAC. and he gave a speech where he called the international campaign against the delegitimization of Israel as the greatest national security threat to Israel. And he basically calls for international pressure to look into the South African government's finances. I mean, this sounds regime change-like to me. And that's basically what I tried to highlight in the article, to say that we should not lose sight of the fact that there's an election in South Africa, there's a lot of internal interest in South Africa, and it won't surprise me if the US or the Israeli lobby or whoever, even a local ambitious politician, will try and leverage this issue to get to basically take power from Ramaphosa and the ANC.
And that's an interesting point you make. You know, again, my story I've told before, I've lived in Kazakhstan, yeah. and I came across color revolution activities in Kazakhstan, and you know, and it's, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place, as you say, regarding, you know, your South African government. It's not that the Kazakh government is wonderful, but I also don't support, it's not democratic to support US empire and its proxies overthrowing, regime changing Kazakhstan. Neither is a good option, and I think it's the same idea here. Do you think, from what I recall, I don't think something like this has really happened before in South Africa. Do you think, you know, who are some of these Western actors? Is it basically the Western Empire and the usual suspects, the open societies, USAID, National Endowment for Democracy?
So it's interesting. So first of all, it did happen. I suspected it happened before in South Africa. Remember the first time I was here on, I talked about AIDS. And when Thabo Mbeki lost power to Jacob Zuma, who was the previous president, we know that the big pharma lobby in particular put a lot of money into Zuma's election campaign to discredit Mbeki on the basis that he was an AIDS denialist. So that is sort of like, you know, you play internal factionalism. Now, it was also true that Mbeki was losing power at the time. So maybe it would have happened without it. And you can see a lot of this happening. Now, the opposition party in South Africa is called the Democratic Alliance. They control only one province, which is the Western Cape, and the demographics are different there. It's one of the places that is the majority is what we call colored, mixed black and white population, and white population. And they tend to be either more sympathetic to Israel or just neutral on this issue. And we know that the opposition leader's shadow minister of foreign affairs was invited to the last Munich conference, NATO conference. So that's sort of like putting it in your face what we're trying to do over here. So that's one type of actor that is involved. And then she called for observers to the South African elections, okay, foreign observers, which include foreign NGOs. Like, she actually said that. And if you look at this stuff, you're like, okay, first of all, South Africa's elections is widely monitored. It's better monitored than the US elections. And we have our own NGOs for what it's worth and observers. And it's really difficult to cheat. For all we know, the elections have been legitimate. So why would you want foreign observers? Then but these groups are not all aligned, as far as I can tell. There's also been a conference, the Brinkhurst Fund, is a South African oligarch fund, who hosted the anti-authoritarian conference in Poland. And again, they invited some opposition party leaders there. We are also seeing breakaway movements from the ANC being amplified in the media. So like Jacob Zuma, the former president, is rather disgruntled, and he started the MK party, who is very prominent in the province of KwaZulu-Natal. And it would seem over there that they are amplifying Zulu nationalism sentiments. So this is the type of tactics that I'm saying. But I can't say that it is one person, one movement. The most concerning one to me, however, is if you look at the map of South Africa, there's a country inside South Africa called Lesotho. And most of Johannesburg's industrial water comes from Lesotho. The United States sent their first ever military plane or something to Lesotho recently. So that's sort of hinting diplomatically at threatening South Africa's water security. So, you know, you're seeing these things in the media and you're like, is my mind drawing lines that it shouldn't be drawing? Or have you and I seen this story before?
Do you think, because it's not, you know, when you look at the history of color revolutions, I wrote my master's thesis on this, they do not always succeed. I haven't looked at the data. It's like maybe 50% of the time, you know, they tried it in Iran. I think in the 2000s, it failed. You know, sometimes they'll succeed, but then years later, it'll be sort of repealed. Do you think that they would be able to succeed? For me, it seems like it doesn't seem so. But also the issue of the BRICS, where South Africa is like the African anchor of BRICS, it just seems like that would also, wouldn't that sort of change a lot of dynamics.
So that's the interesting one. I don't know what to make of BRICS, because BRICS inside South Africa doesn't feel as great as people talk about it outside of the country. South Africa's biggest trading partner is China, but just below that is the United States. So we almost par with the US. And if you add all the Western countries, China is dwarfed by them. So the US also has what we call AGOA, which is a free trade union agreement for the African continent. And they have hinted before at kicking South Africa out of this. So we don't get preferential trade there. So this is sort of like carrots and sticks approach. So I'm not sure to what extent BRICS plays a role in this, but it's obviously being perceived that way outside of the US. But I think the one that really ticked off the US and particularly Israeli lobby is the fact that South Africa took Israel to the International Court of Justice and used the genocide word, which you're not allowed to use against Israel. Okay. And it happens to be that Naledi Pandor, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, is Muslim. Okay, she's a converted Muslim, and she's married to a very sympathetical Palestinian, well, he's not Palestinian, South African Muslim, but he's very sympathetical to the Palestinians. And they've even had Ilan Pappe in South Africa, you know, all the anti-Israeli preachers, if you will. So she's not very popular internationally, but she is quite committed in her anti-Israeli rhetoric internationally, and that's really ticked off. And she was at Washington, in Washington recently at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and people should really see this. This exchange between her and the U.S. Was it the spokesperson, the guy who interviewed her, basically. And he asked her a question about BRICS. And he said, oh, but you're trying to invite new authoritarian regimes in. And he mentioned like Egypt, UAE, I can't remember the other one, and Iran. So they said, okay, four of them. And then he's like, do you think Iran is authoritarian? And then a response was like, I don't know if she's authoritarian, but women, this and this. You want to say something about women. And then before she could finish the sentence, she was cut off. She's like, then the guys were like, the South African foreign minister is basically saying that Iran is not an authoritarian regime. And this was quoted all over the media. So this is the type of propaganda attacks that we're seeing against South Africa. It's like things taken out of context. And if you actually read those articles, the text of the article is reasonable. I mean, it's a bit biased, but it's, you can figure out, okay, maybe she couldn't finish the sentence, but you can't figure it out from the headline, right? And this is the type of things we're seeing.
And then again, as you mentioned, Israel, Gaza. Now, I just saw a clip of Netanyahu saying they're going to expand. Israel is going to expand settlements into Gaza. And I think it's clear. I'm looking at this from an objective perspective. I'm someone who supports the existence of a state of Israel, but beyond that, I don't support demolishing people's homes, kicking them out, killing them. And so it's clear that it's expansionist. Israel is expansionist. There's this talk of the greater Israel. So it seems like that is what's going on. And you can talk about there's a lot of issues to discuss when it comes to Israel, Gaza, and whatnot. But for me, kind of, I'm always looking at the bigger picture. My biggest concern is this all being used as pretext for initiating war with a wider regional war with
Iran.
Iran. You know, what's your take on the situation? And, you know, for you personally, what's most interesting or most important?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you say look at it like through a hardcore realist view, you would say Israel is the U.S. aircraft carrier to the Middle East, right? It's their foothold into the region. And they basically using the Israeli government to dish up blows to whoever is disobedient to them in that region, whether it's an authoritarian or democratic regime, doesn't matter. And when Wesley Clark's famous speech, right, we had seven countries and six out of the seven have been taken out except Iran. We should not lose sight of that. So it's clear to me that there's a certain lobby in Washington and in Israel that basically would like to invade Iran. And Israel's foreign policy, and this is what Gareth Porter explained to me when I looked at the Iranian nuclear weapons, has always been they want to sort of draw the U.S. into a regional conflict or pin the U.S. down in the Middle East to be their baton, basically, because Israel itself cannot really, you know, fight anything meaningful outside of their own borders. I mean, they're struggling in Gaza to subdue a bunch of thugs, basically, if you look at Hamas that way. They can't do much more than that. So they need the U.S. to be there. And we saw now with the recent rocket attacks that had it not been for U.S. assistance and even assistance from the Arab states next door, it's questionable if Israel would have been able to take down those rockets, right? So from an Israeli survival perspective, they want the U.S. to be there. And there's this incentive to try and draw the U.S. into regional conflicts. And we saw this now that when Joe Biden basically started saying no to Netanyahu, and it wasn't like a thorough no, it was just like subtle hints, they stopped bombing the embassy in Damascus to amplify the issues around the region. And then Netanyahu himself has got personal ambition in this, where he doesn't want to go to jail, because if his presidency ends, he's facing a jail sentence for corruption. And what isn't mentioned in his corruption case is that Netanyahu is tied to the uranium smuggling mafia in the United States, where they're smuggling enriched uranium to Israel. And Israel has something like 93 nuclear weapons. So if the truth of this court case comes out, something else comes into play, which is if Israeli nuclear weapons is fully acknowledged, then under existing U.S. law, like the Symington-Glenn amendments, all military aid to Israel must be suspended. That can actually be enforced if a lawyer brings it to the U.S. So you can see Netanyahu is staying out of jail. There's a lot of incentives to not open up that story. And I think part of this conflict has got to do with that.
What's the word on the street in Tehran, in Iran, you know, via your wife or whatnot? Any thoughts on what that world is thinking about all of this?
Well, we spoke to them a little bit, to the people we know over there. And by and large, they've always been in this situation for a long time. They don't know if they're coming or going war, but they were also on the edge of their seats when it started, because nobody thought that they would actually attack. The thinking from those who justify it, let me say, has been this, is that it's about time that Iran draws a line in the sand and say to Israel, now you've gone too far. I think even the U.S. have sort of accepted that this was not an intention to attack Israel outright. Obviously, it attacked military targets. It sent rockets over Israel. But Iran mostly sent drones. And what we can figure out is it was sort of like a reconnaissance exercise to figure out where their defenses is. And it's basically saying to them, now we know where to shoot next time. So shut up and don't do this again. So it's basically putting deterrence back. That's how a lot of people are interpreting it. And now the Israelis are obviously saying, we're going to attack again. Iran has shut down their nuclear power station in Bushehr out of fear that that might be attacked as a precaution. So, you know, there's preparations in Iran as well. And as usual, the Iranians are squeezed in between the sanctions because, I mean, their government is nothing to celebrate either.
And just your thought then on the wider war, because I feel everything that's going on, it's part of this multi-front wider war. Ukraine, the Israel-Iran theater, the coming theater seemingly of Indo-Pacific, Taiwan, and China. And, you know, you're just seeing some, you know, a higher amount of signals, articles being published and rhetoric from both East and West on World War III. And it just seems like this crescendo that's building. You know, you listen to the Russian intellectuals like Dugin, who's saying, I mean, I thought it was kind of a bit too much. He was on his Telegram saying he's pumped. He's like, let's get this World War III started. It's like, dude, come on. That's crazy.
But you see, what I think the incentive has been that there's a military industrial complex in all these countries, really, to basically keep the fear of the other guy alive, to keep military spending and government spending alive. And all of this comes down to that. So how do you end these wars? Is you cut the money. Somebody in Congress, it's never going to happen, but has to basically cut the U.S. military budget. But that won't happen. I mean, Ron Paul used to make this argument that they will never listen to him. It'll happen the day that the dollar is inflated. Okay. And I think it's the same for the ruble. It's the same for the Chinese. Because a lot of these conflicts you can end through negotiation. I mean, the U.S. could have just gone to Iran and the Israelis, and you buy them drinks or whatever they drink in Iran, tea. And you say, okay, sit around the table and please stop killing each other. And we'll, you know, give you a little bit of incentives and negotiations and trade, and you can end the conflicts. But the militaries on both sides don't want to end the conflict because they need an enemy to justify the spending. That's basically how I see it. So I sort of hope that these conflicts stay like that, that it's just like, you know, sort of dancing around the table all the time. But if it's a real outright war with Iran, this will be devastating because even though Iran – so first of all, Iran doesn't have much of an economy. Its economy is the size of South Africa's, and South Africa is the size of Maryland. That's not the world power. So the fear is obviously exaggerated. Iran's military spending is a third the size of Israel's. But sure, it's got a large population, so maybe it can support a war effort much longer. But, you know, the U.S. can invade Iran and destroy it quickly if it wants to, except for the fact that the Iranians have got a ton of missiles stationed in Bushehr that if they are really attacked, they'll send into the Saudi Arabian oil fields on the other side of the Gulf, and they'll take the world economy down with them. So that's basically what Iran's tactic is. It's like they build a massive fortress around Iran and say, if you ever invade us, we're going to take you down with us. So, I just hope that never happens. And I don't think, at least the signs we're seeing in the U.S. has been, okay, whoa, this is not Iraq. Let's not have another war. But I still don't trust the Washington consensus, because they say one thing and then they say to the Israelis, go again. So, and we know the Israelis are going to try and exploit this as much as possible because they want to drag the U.S. into that conflict.
Yeah, and there are different groups of extremists, I think, in all of these camps, right? In Washington, Brussels, in London, in Tel Aviv, in Tehran, in Moscow, where they want to sort of initiate this eschatological, in their mind, conflict. So, and then I think there are other more reasonable forces within these same camps who kind of like stop them from going there, but you just never... No, you mentioned Ron Paul. I was actually invited, it's about a week or two ago, to Ron Paul's house in Texas. But I, for whatever reason, I couldn't make it. But that would have been fun. Maybe next time. And then moving to energy, which you focus on. And I've been having some guests to talk about energy. It's a complicated subject, but it's an important subject. I think energy is being used now as a pretext to take away some of our freedoms. You know, Germany, they're talking about banning cars on weekends. Absolute insanity. I still stick to the view that I think we have generally an abundance in energy, and that they're basically creating this artificial scarcity in our minds as a pretext to take control of energy, to then control the world.
Yes.
Any thoughts on that? And then these ideas of banning cars, introducing carbon social credits and stuff like that.
So, yeah, let's start with the energy. Energy is a debate. Is it a commodity or a service? I actually believe it's a service. So, you know, it's actually more like a cell phone contract, if you think of it. You pay a fixed tariff and you should theoretically be able to use as much as you can, or to a certain limit, right? But they sell it like a commodity. So it's being sold as if it's a pot of gold, or as if it can run out, but it can't. Because if you accept solar is unlimited, hello, that solar panel is going to go forever. And there's enough oil, there's enough gas, there's enough uranium. I mean, there's no shortage of energy in the world. So because it is perceived as a commodity or sold like a commodity, what is very important is the supply and demand balance. And those who play it well will try and exploit that balancing curve. So the Russians will, you know, try. The Russians, for example, for a very long time, funded anti-fracking campaigns in Europe, because had they been fracking, the Russians would be out of the European market. Okay, it's just business, and there's a geopolitical leverage to Nord Stream. The U.S. is the same. The U.S. exploited fracking, and then they stopped. Didn't want the technology to spread to the rest of the world. Japan, for example, in the aftermath of Fukushima, there was a scare story funded by the oil and gas industry to get Japan to shut down the nuclear reactors. Had it not been for the increase in demand from Japan, the U.S. would not have expanded the offshore oil and gas industry, right? So there's seven major energy sources, and they're all like mafias. And the recent mafias that came to the party, and it used to be five, is now the wind and the solar industry. And they're acting the same way as the coal industry used to act historically, or as the nuclear industry used to act, which is they're trying to have a captured market. So if you take South Africa, for example, because I know the statistics, our industrial demand is about 70,000 gigawatts. So you know what the market size is. And if you've got a few solar panels or you've got a few nuclear power stations, you know everyone else is out of it, right? So that's why it's got this mafia-like behavior, because there's a limited demand and there's infinite supply. And you want to be the guy for that little bit of a market. Even though the market is small, the capitalization is large. So there's a lot of money in it. And that's why you see wars over energy and stuff. But yeah, I don't believe there's a shortage of energy, of any energy fuel, really. But it's being perceived that way. And it plays a pretext. I mean, the U.S. didn't invade Mugabe in Zimbabwe at the same time as Saddam Hussein, even though they did the same things. They invaded Iraq because there's oil, as we all know. So, yeah, it definitely it's part of the carrots and sticks.
We discussed this before, and you were more optimistic in a previous podcast, you discussed the situation historically in South Africa and trying to implement some of these systems. But you know, you being working in energy, what's your sort of latest thoughts on this Great Reset project, right? This dystopian technocracy where our governments are pushing these digital IDs now, talking about CBDCs, where they want to overlay this system. And if this is installed now, that would then physically limit us from doing many things. And, you know, just any thoughts on this. I use sort of a Great Reset as this exaggerated overarching term for all of this stuff, but you know, any thoughts on this agenda?
So I mean, the technocracy, Patrick, what's his name? Patrick
Woods.
Wood's book was really good, Technocracy Rising. And I mean, it is a technocracy is a social movement, the way I see it. And there's a clear attempt, so sustainable development goes by various names, to the way it describes that they try and measure everything and they collect like mass data. And then they think if they can manipulate the data, they can manipulate the people. But I think it stands in contrast to what we know about free markets, which is that people find a way out of these systems in some way. Not fully, and you won't always escape it. I mean, not everybody could escape communism, but even under communism, people carved out like a limited space of freedom for themselves, right? There was even a free market in Russia at that time, even though it was theoretically illegal. So good example. Now they're trying to limit your energy usage. Well, buy a solar panel if you've got energy during the day. How can they stop the sun, as an example, right? I think like people will find ways around it. How do they stop? They want to push everyone to go electrical. Well, buy a diesel generator and increase demand for diesel. And I do believe that if they are going to, push this too far, you're going to have black markets that is going to bypass it. And I don't believe that the surveillance technology is sophisticated enough to stop everybody at once, but they will try and signal out people. So that's sort of how I see the thing. There's a lot of control freaks in charge. But what I have come to accept over the last few years is that these control freaks are not aligned in what they want. The one guy wants to control climate and your carbon footprint. The other one wants to control your energy usage. The other guy wants you to vaccinate all the time. And there seems to be a lot of factions and mafias fighting over each other. So I'm optimistic that whatever system they implement, even though it's going to be damaging over the long run, it just possibly can't work.
A lot of my guests are coming to this similar conclusion, and it'll be kind of like a bad version. You know, I always cite the film Brazil, 1985 film, where they might advance with some of these things, but it's going to be like a really poor version of dystopia.
Well, take this view, right? Okay, let's assume you've got this architecture. Let's just go into practicalities. Most people in the DRC don't have electricity yet. Most people in Africa have a lower energy consumption than the UAE in a fridge per person. How are you going to implement it with that infrastructure? Like just logistics, just the basic stuff of this, it doesn't add up to me. I mean, look at Mexico. Mexico's got a lot of poverty, a lot of social issues, like traditional social issues. And now you want people to follow this rule? Do you really think that's going to work in practice? So I do think some people will inevitably follow it. We saw it with COVID. But we also saw with COVID how resilient people were. Eventually, the system cracked because there's a lot of people said this thing doesn't make sense. And the people who raised their voices, they were not all saying there is no virus. I still see people fighting over that, by the way, which I just find so stupid so many years later. But, you know, not everyone was there, but they were saying, okay, at least some of what we've been told has been nonsense. And that's slowly how the system cracks.
Yeah. And if you live in the analog world, it's like, what can they do? I met someone recently in Mexico who they live old fashioned, like without even electricity. So, I mean, if you're living in the house where, you know, you're living old fashioned analog, it's like this system just goes right over your head. Like it's not even relevant, you know. I guess we'll see. I mean, you might have some freedoms restricted, but you know, we've covered a lot of interesting stuff. You know, any other thoughts for us that you have that you want to get across on any of these issues?
No, I would just say that sort of last statement on this is sort of what I said about the virus, no virus stuff, is that some people really need to move on from that world, okay? They stop fighting whether there was planes on 9/11 or not. I still see people fighting over that. I don't care. There's a lot of other new issues to fight over, right? Well, people still care how Kennedy was killed. It doesn't matter. The guy's dead. You know, things of that nature. You know the basis of the stories that you've been lied to, but you don't need to go into every little detail about all these things. move on and move to something more contemporary? And then, like, it's a question of your own time and energy, how you want to spend it, basically.
I think this is an excellent point, and why I've gotten tired of the JFK stuff. I mean, there's people still putting out books, and I'm like, who cares?
Really?
Like, it's you know, you dig into it. I've read James Douglas's JFK and the Unspeakable, fantastic book, but it's like, and then as you say, like 9/11, the official narrative is there. Nothing's going to happen now. And the COVID stuff, it's just like, come on. I just can't. And you know, that's one reason I left TNT, because I couldn't. I think it's not emotionally to be looking at this stuff every single day. It's not healthy.
And I mean, even the Ukraine story is dying, right? We're seeing that. Nobody talks about that anymore. Currently, the biggest issue is whether we want to stop another war of Iran. Now, I don't see how the death of JFK is going to change anything about that story, right? Or things of that nature. So, yeah, it's good to revisit them every now and then. But, I mean, move on and spend your time more productively. That's what I would tell a lot of people. So, yeah, that's what I've been trying to do. I've been writing and getting more involved with local South African politics, where I think I've got the biggest impact, especially on the energy issue. And then other than that, you know, just I think people need to start enjoying themselves a little bit more.
Enjoy life, make babies, go out into nature, socialize, that sort of stuff. All right, Hugo, it's always great to reconnect. Tell us again, I'll include all your links, but where are the best places for people to find your stuff?
So they can follow me on Twitter. Okay, it's my name, Hugo Krier, Hugo Kruger. You can find me on Substack. It's the same thing, but just please put the links in the description. And then I'm still on YouTube. I don't know if I'm being soft and shadow banned, but my subscribers haven't gone up a lot. But I also haven't been that active, so maybe it's due to that reason.
Pentagon. So that's what I do. Pentagon Tube, as I like to call it. All right, thanks for being on Geopolitics and Empire.
All right, thank you very much, Jorge.
I hope you enjoyed this Geopolitics and Empire podcast. The website is geopoliticsandempire.com, and I encourage you to sign up for the free email list that goes out with each podcast and every weekend with a collection of news headlines. The newsletter and website are our last lines of defense. We're being censored and deplatformed. It's nearly impossible to find Geopolitics and Empire on the Google search engine. We've been blacklisted. YouTube frequently takes down our videos with strikes. Facebook restricts our page. Reddit and Twitter take down posts. And after the Associated Press mentioned Geopolitics and Empire in a 2021 article co-written with NATO, our Patreon account was terminated. Vimeo also terminated our pro account. The best free way to help Geopolitics and Empire is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere and subscribe to all of our media channels. You can find the video broadcast now on 5 platforms: Odyssey, Rockfin, Rumble, BitChute, and Brighteon. You can find the audio broadcast on the podcast ecosystem: SoundCloud, Apple, Spotify, and so on. My current favorite social media channels are Twitter and Telegram, but you can also find us on Gab, MeWe, Minds, Float, VK, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Finally, Geopolitics and Empire is in dire need of funding to continue. You can leave a donation, purchase a consultation with the host, or become a member to receive additional benefits. We also produce a weekly broadcast called Dissident Thinker for members and Rockfin subscribers only. We will continue to fight the good fight, come hell or high water. Thank you for listening.